And welcome to Inside Education. We're online at insideed.com. I'm Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. Coming up on this week's programme.
So that if the teacher in a way takes a step back and allows this to happen, that children actually feel empowered and actually learn mathematics in that way.
To mark the end of Maths Week, we'll find out why children can learn more maths if we as educators tell them less. We'll also have a review of a new book on education, co-authored by a member of the Department of Education and Science Inspectorate. Now, as you know, Barry Hennessy started a new series about the international PISA test on last week's programme. We're deferring part two of the series this week, with apologies to those of you who are expecting it, but Barry wants to talk this week about a couple of interesting educational matters that have arisen.
Yes, indeed. Hello to you, Sean. Well, these are a couple of issues which arguably run the risk of getting buried a little bit in the large amount of airtime and column inches being devoted to Thursday's election and the referenda, not to mention the European crisis. But the Department of Education appears to be rowing back on two of the major changes that were to make themselves felt in schools over the months ahead. Later we'll tell you about a major U-turn on junior cert reform, but before that we turn to the first chink in the armour with regard to the implications for schools of a large number of teacher retirements due to take effect on or before the 29th of February. As many of you will be aware, that date is the limit for public servants eligible for retirement to leave their posts without their pensions being impacted by the pay cuts imposed since the onset of the economic crisis. Now, if no exception is made for the education sector, a large number of classroom teachers, in addition to principals and deputy principals, will leave schools over the months ahead. In their place, a raft of vacancies will have to be filled in the run-up to the state exams. This weekend, an article in the Irish Independent suggested that retiring teachers would be allowed to return to schools to finish out the year with their exam classes, but at the lowest rate on the teachers' pay scale. I've been discussing this idea with Ferdia Kelly, who's the General Secretary of the Joint Managerial Body.
Obviously, as school managers and principals, we're concerned about continuity of teaching and learning, and particularly for exam classes in the coming year, that with 8 or 9 weeks left of a school term, we wouldn't have a large number of vacancies and discontinuity as far as students finishing out a programme. So we have been raising the issue with the Department of Education officials, I suppose in the first instance, hoping that something could be done at macro level. In other words, in the public sector, that teachers could be excused from the regulation around the 29th of February, and it could be extended to the end of the term in early June. Unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be the case. So we've been asking that the Department of Education skills officials would look at alternatives in order to avoid a crisis emerging in schools. And this is one of the ideas that has arisen as a consequence of those requests.
Any relief that comes through, certainly a reading of the article would suggest that it may only be in respect of the exam classes that these teachers are teaching.
Yeah, and that seems to be the case. The focus is on exam classes. Now, our concern with that, Barry, would be that teachers obviously teach more than exam classes, so it creates a part-time teaching post for the remainder of the teacher's hours. And our concern is that teachers in other schools, or maybe even in the same school, would apply for that part-time post. They themselves may, in fact, be teaching exam classes. They may be successful in their applications, as they're entitled to be successful. They may decide to move post-teaching post in early March of next year. And they may subsequently, because they move, another vacancy occurs, and that could occur among exam classes just as readily as among other classes. So you have what we call in the system, I suppose, the churn effect or the knock-on effect of a retirement creating a vacancy, and in turn maybe creating another knock-on vacancy or possibly even a further one.
Yeah, because Ferdia, I suspect that the more general listener or reader of newspapers maybe isn't, I suppose, getting the full picture on this, that it's not just mainstream classroom teachers who'll be retiring, but it's also filling of principal and deputy principal vacancies where those arise. And as you say, the possibility for teachers maybe who are non-permanent, to start applying for jobs in schools that would be more convenient perhaps to where they live.
Absolutely. It's right across the, not just the public sector, as I said earlier, but it's across all employees within schools. have the potential to retire, and we've got to respect that. But as you say, it could be a principal, it could be a deputy principal, it would be another permanent teacher typically who would be appointed in a competition to fill a post of principal or deputy. That in turn will take that permanent teacher out of the classroom to become a full-time principal. So therefore, straight away, there's a vacancy left in the classroom where that person who's now principal on the 1st of March will have been a teacher on the 29th of February, and his or her classes will be taken up. So, the number of scenarios, Barry, is quite serious. And I suppose the bottom line here is if some way could be found to allow the education sector to be excused from the regulation around the 29th of February, it would certainly save all of those problems. But we're told that can't happen, that education can't be different than the rest of the public sector. But we're really seriously concerned about the knock-on effects on teaching and learning in classes.
Ferdia Kelly of the JMB there with an issue that really underlines the consequences of a one-size-fits-all approach to a sector whose cloth is cut once a year, and which has already taken real cuts to frontline resources over the past 3 years. Now, bear in mind that Rory Quinn, during the general election campaign, famously referred to the Department of Education as malevolently dysfunctional. Listening to the picture Ferdia Kelly paints there of disruption to teaching and learning after Christmas, you'd imagine this is one area it would be in the Minister's interest to make a stand on. Now, the other issue to mention concerns junior cert reform, where the Minister for Education, Rory Quinn, this week announced a major U-turn on plans to impose a limit of 8 examination subjects on students entering first year secondary in 2012. The proposal had been widely criticised as ill thought out across the education sector, particularly by the teaching unions, who'd pointed to the difficulties for teachers that would stem from having some children in the class taking a subject for examination and others who weren't. Moreover, it wasn't clear whether certain subjects that up to now were a core part of the curriculum would end up becoming optional in schools if teacher allocations were reduced in line with the change. The official line from the Department of Education now is that the 8 subject limit will take effect for first year students entering in 2014 as part of a broader junior cert reform. But here at Inside Education, we know that 3 years is an eternity in politics. And to paraphrase, if it looks like a U-turn and sounds like a U-turn, well, we'll let you at home do the duck test. Sean.
Thanks for that, Barry. And Barry Hennessy will continue his series on PISA on next week's programme. I'm now happy to introduce you to a new regular reporter on Inside Education. It is Sinead Burke. You're welcome on board, Sinead. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
My name is Sinead Burke and I'm a newly qualified teacher. I qualified in May, but I'm currently undergoing further study. I'm doing my 4th year in Cloisthuaar Marina, and I have great interest in TV and radio, and I'm hoping in the future to marry both my career of teaching and my career in the radio industry, perhaps.
Well, we wish you all the very best with that, Sinead. And to introduce your first contribution, we're going to listen to a piece of music that you brought with you this week. Yes, Sinead's first assignment on Inside Education is to review a new book on education. The book is called The Classroom X Factor: The Power of Body Language and Nonverbal Communication in Teaching. It was written by Department of Education Inspector Dr. John White and Professor John Gardner from Queen's University in Belfast. Sinead, the book is called The Classroom X Factor. Has it got anything to do with the TV series of the same name?
It relates to the TV series basically just by title, in what is The X Factor. And The X Factor is so, I suppose, engrossed in popular culture at this stage that the book and the authors use this title to capture the audience. But myself, when I first began to read, I did question what is The X Factor. And the Cambridge Advanced Learners Dictionary, they define The X Factor as a quality that you cannot describe, which makes someone very special. So when you're reflecting back on previous series, what is the X Factor? The winner of this competition is not always the person with the greatest voice, but often they're the one who captures the audience's attention through their personality and their interests and traits. And this relates again back to the classroom. If you think back to your past, your favourite teacher may not have been the one with the most curriculum knowledge, but the one who really engaged with the classroom, listened to them, respected them, and maybe did things with different methodologies.
So how can a teacher get the Classroom X Factor then, according to this book?
According to this book, The Classroom X Factor is based on nonverbal communication. And this is something which is innate to every person, not only teachers. But by reading this book and by examining the different methods of nonverbal communication, teachers can recognise the things which they do and improve on this nonverbal communication. I found most interesting to realise that a smile can be detected from a distance as far as 300 feet away. And children as young as 9 years of age can detect whether the smile that the teacher is wearing is a real smile or a false smile. And this is very important in the classroom. If a child tells you something which they think is of great importance, and maybe not to your day, but they can detect whether you have real interest. And the difference is, in a real smile, there is movement around the eyes, but in a false smile, there is none. So children can detect that at quite a young age. In relation to the eyes themselves, nonverbal communication can leak unconsciously to the person who is communicating, how they feel and the emotions they express towards another person. In the classroom, have you ever considered a child who is demonstrating challenging behaviour? How often do you look at this child? How often do you glance around the classroom at these children? And children can perceive this quite readily. They understand that if the teacher doesn't look at them that often, they think that the teacher has no interest in them or does not like them. And it's something that I will now be much more conscious of in the classroom, to give an equal, I suppose, differentiate the amount of times I look at the children in my class. And the final thing is space in the classroom and where the teacher stands. And there is a zone of teaching, it's called the teaching zone, and this is where the children of high, low and middle participation sit in the classroom, and it's a kite shape, and the children who are straight in front of you, they get the most of your attention. But as we know, children are not free to move around in the classroom, they are sitting in specific places. So in order to gain the best amount of participation in the classroom, the teacher should voluntarily move around the classroom and change the teaching zone so that each child gets an active amount of participation, and they can engage high, low or medium depending on their topic of interest.
And if you were to sum up the message of the book in a few sentences, what would it be?
That nonverbal communication is absolutely, you know, vital for primary school education, and that this is something which each individual can improve on themselves. And you need to project the right messages through your nonverbal communication as you do through your words. Nonverbal communication often leaks out through maybe different, the way we look at children, the way we point, your gestures and things like that, because the brain has a capacity where 12% of it is primarily organised by what the hands and things like that are doing. So the message, the primary message, is that you should improve your nonverbal communication as much as possible for the benefit of you yourself and the benefit of the children in front of you. The book is extremely easy to read, and it quotes from a number of studies which have been done in the past, but in a very readable format. You can sit down and become engrossed. But it also gives examples in the classroom situations, which is excellent practice for the newly qualified teacher, because they can see this, you know, and how it would actually work in the classroom. But for the experienced teacher, many things which have come out recently are improved on in this book, and I think it is a great reference to any teacher and to any individual, because I think with nonverbal communication, it is relevant in every situation.
It's a relatively long book, Sinead, just under 200 pages. How is it organised?
It is organised in three different sections. It is organised in sections to do with the X Factor, and I suppose the composition of the show itself. It's organised into the X Factor and you, the teacher, the X Factor and the orchestra, so the different players in the X Factor in the classroom, so the different methodologies which you use to promote your X Factor, and then the X Factor and different pedagogical responses and different theories and things like that. But the book and the authors advise that you don't sit down and read the book in one, I suppose, session, but it really is engrossing. You sit down and you realise, oh my goodness, that's what I do with my hands, or that's what I should be doing, or, you know, mimicking children's behaviour, and you instantly become, once I think you become hooked immediately in the book, and it's very easy to sit there for a couple of days and become fluent, I suppose, in nonverbal communication.
Shay, was there anything that the book left out or that might have made it a better read?
The book was systematically organised, and I knew at each step what was coming next, and at the end of each chapter there was a reference to what had previously been studied. So in that case, I don't think so. I think that it was an excellent read, and the authors themselves, John White and John Gardner, have huge experience in the area of education and working with children, and you can really see the exemplary, I suppose, examples that they give and how it would work in the classroom. And I think it is a must read for any teacher coming out of education or who has been practicing.
So that's definitely a thumbs up from this for the Classroom X Factor. How much does it cost, Sinead, and where is it available?
The book, it costs €29.05 and it is available in Easons online on their website at www.easons.com.
And thanks to Sinead Burke, who brought us that review of The Classroom X Factor by John White and John Gardner. Sinead will be back next week with a report on interactive whiteboards. You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Podcasts of previous programmes can be downloaded from iTunes or from our website, which is insideed.com. You can contact the programme by text message on 086 8962 665. The last week saw students and educators all over the country engaged in various maths activities as part of Maths Week. To mark the end of that week, I have been speaking to Dr. Therese Dooley, who is a lecturer in mathematics education in St. Patrick's College, Drumcondra. Dr. Dooley has conducted research into how children learn mathematics. In particular, she has found that telling children what to do and how to do it in maths is not necessarily the best way to support their learning. I began by asking Therese to explain what she means by telling in maths class.
I think that there's a great tendency in maths classes for the teacher to give a formula, to tell a formula, to rush into telling and not to allowing children to think for themselves. So that if a child, for example, or children don't come up with an answer very quickly, there's a case where the teacher actually tries to draw the answer either from the child or children themselves or from other children. And there's an emphasis on getting speedy, quick answers. That's one aspect of it. Another aspect is just giving the formula, telling children what a procedure is. So let me give an example. When adding fractions, it's children's often feel that by, say, adding a half and a third, that you add the numerator and add the denominators. You add one and one to make two and two and three to make five, getting an answer of 2/5, which seems perfectly reasonable. They're bringing ideas from the world of whole numbers to that of fractions. So very often what teachers do is they give the rule. And the rule, of course, is find the common denominator of 2 and 3, which is 6, and then making the conversion of a half to 3 over 6 and a third to 2 over 6, so we get an answer of 5 over 6. So the teacher very often gives this as a procedure. Find the lowest common denominator, change the fractions, and add the numerator, the two numerators, rather than having children really think this out for themselves and tease it out for themselves. So I'm not saying that all telling is wrong, but this idea that maths is about giving procedures and giving formulas and not allowing children to really think mathematically for themselves.
And why is it a problem, say, you know, if I take another one that teachers often give children, that is, say, for finding the area of a rectangle, you multiply the length by the width. Why is it a problem telling children that rather than letting the children find out for themselves?
There are two aspects to that. I think that we'd all know that by just telling doesn't mean that children actually understand why it's the case. And there's also a sense that they might overgeneralise and think that all area is about finding length by width. And that really only applies, you know, in the case of a rectangle. The other aspect of it is that children aren't really agents themselves in mathematics. What they learn about mathematics is that it's the teacher who holds the power in mathematics. The teacher knows, or the textbook knows, or the authority resides somewhere else other than themselves. So they don't have any agency as such, that they don't really feel that much part of mathematics. They are passive learners. And in that sense, they're learning a message about mathematics that I think is causing a lot of the problem we have, say, at the end of second level, going into third level, where children, or students, are disengaged and disempowered in the process of learning mathematics.
So if children then don't really learn that well from being told things like that, how do they learn maths?
It's a very big question. Let me just give some examples. And of course, there's a whole body of theory in terms of how children actually learn mathematics. But from my own research, I found that actually giving children complex problems, real mathematic problems to solve, where they are encouraged to think and to, for example, let me give an example again, thinking about the number of fractions on a segment of the number line, thinking about how many fractions there might be between zero and a half. Children love to think about infinity, and yet that word isn't mentioned anywhere in the mathematics curriculum. Children deal with it at all kinds of levels, at all ages, And yet we try to confine their thinking to certain numbers and keeping it quite simple for them. So I think there's that aspect of actually engaging with deep mathematics and sophisticated mathematics. Also, I think that children can learn a lot from each other. There are other ways to have, say, whole class conversation where children actually begin to conjecture and think about what might be and could be and probably could be. Where children actually, in that sense, and using that kind of language of vagueness, start to build on each other's ideas and to actually evaluate other children's ideas. So that if the teacher, in a way, takes a step back and allows this to happen, that children actually feel empowered and actually learn mathematics in that way. And they learn from each other. Another aspect of this is time. Again, does this habit of mathematics lessons take place in maybe a 35 or 40 minute section? That homework has to be given at the end of the class. There's no time for children to engage in possibility thinking, to move away from a problem and come back to it maybe later in the day or the following day. And yet, in all other aspects of the curriculum, we tend to allow that possibility thinking to happen. It can be an open question like, how many fractions you think there might be on a segment of a number line.
Or another one you asked the children in your research was the sum of all the numbers from 1 to 100.
Absolutely. And the children were highly engaged by this and actually came up with formulae for this that I had never anticipated. The normal one that we would often think about is where children, you know, where some of the children actually found this, where they added 1 to 99, 2 to 98, 3 to 97 and so on, and actually found the formula this way. But some children began to think about the sums of decades, and I had never thought about that. I never realised that from 1 to 10 is 55, from 11 to 20 is 155, and so on. But children, by actually having time to think about it and by listening to each other's ideas, actually came up with those methods for finding this. Again, I think there's often the sense that children shouldn't really feel any kind of uncertainty in a classroom. There's always, in a mathematics classroom, that there's always a sense, you know, where children actually come up with different ideas to problems, that they might feel some kind of confusion. And children actually need to have that level of confusion to be actually think about what the solution might be.
So maybe today's confusion is tomorrow's learning.
That's exactly where it is. And I think there's been a move, there's too much certainty and all aspects of mathematics lessons. I don't want to say that there should be, the children should feel too insecure, that the problem has to be at a level that they feel that they can engage. And I think there have to be problems where there are multiple entry points. Not all children are going to solve the problem in the same way or at the same level of sophistication. But the problem has to be one that all children can feel that they have something to contribute to it. So from that end, say, for example, even if we were to think about the problem that you mentioned, adding the numbers from 1 to 100, that all children could begin to think, well, I know how to add 1 and 2 and 3 up to 10, so they could enter into the problem. Some children, as I said, developed quite sophisticated methods and for solving that problem. Not all children hit that level of reasoning, but they all felt some level of success in solving the problem.
And Therese, if a teacher's role then is not to tell children things, what is the teacher's role in a maths lesson?
Well, the teacher has to devise the problem. The teacher has to encourage that kind of mathematical thinking. Let me see. I've already mentioned about the IRE structure in the maths lesson.
That's initiation by the teacher, response by the child, and then evaluation by the teacher.
And sometimes it can be a kind of funneling where if the child doesn't give the correct response, that the teacher will funnel, so will keep asking to try and do the thinking for the child. But there are other ways that the teacher can deal with the kind of conversation or discussion in a class. And there's a lot of attention has been paid to the idea of revoicing. So that when a child gives a response in a classroom, that the teacher might revoice that contribution and might say something like, so you think the response is, let me, to say adding 1 to 100 is, let's say for argument's sake, 1,000. And leave it there somewhere. Leave it and maybe record on the blackboard or on the digital whiteboard or and allow other children then to comment on that kind of response. The teacher has a very difficult job to do, because at the end of the day, there are correct mathematical solutions. So the teacher has to find a way to guide the discussion that ensues, but at the same time, she has at the same time to manage the agency that children also need to have. Revoicing has received a lot of attention in the literature. Of course, revoicing can be done to actually to maintain a particular point of view. So it's not that it's all necessarily good, but if it's done a certain way to maintain children's ideas, well, then I think it can have very beneficial effect.
And revoicing is putting what somebody says in their own words, or saying it, repeating it.
In the public realm, yeah, of the class, and allowing other children then to comment on it. Another move that the teacher might make in response to a child's contribution is to probe his or her thinking. Why do you think that? On what basis do you think this? So really, it's a child who has to do the thinking and make his or her thinking clear to others. And at the same time, the teacher has to keep an eye on the fact, on the correctness of the mathematical idea, but has to actually at the same time guide the mathematics and ensure that the ideas that will actually bring about the correct response are actually kept in the public realm. So it's actually very tricky and difficult for the teacher. It's far more difficult than just simply telling.
And Therese, does the approach of not telling children in maths, does it work for all children, or does it make a difference if we're talking about high achievers in maths or low achievers in maths? Does it make a difference to them whether or not the telling is practiced?
From my own research, what really surprised me more than anything was the contributions that were made, and very, very positive contributions that were made by children who were thought to be or considered to be low attainers in mathematics. And I think it was because they felt they had a role to play, because they could use words like maybe it's or it could be, and where the emphasis wasn't on certainty, that they made contributions to the class that were highly valuable. In my own research, I looked at how whole class conversation can actually foster mathematical thinking in the class. I can only talk about what happened with certain individuals. I'm not able to generalise, but I thought that was a very powerful aspect of the study, and something I'd like to delve into in a deeper way.
And that was Dr. Therese Dooley from St. Patrick's College, Drumcondra. That's it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com or on iTunes. You can email us by writing to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. I want to thank my guest on this week's programme, Dr. Therese Dooley from St. Patrick's College, and to my colleagues Barry Hennessy and Sinead Burke. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening. Thank you.